It's an elevated superhero thing, really a meditation on grief told through 70 years of sitcoms. And Zach Braff is directing. We're friends, so fingers crossed.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 479 for the week of October 2nd, 2023. I am carefully hidden crotch phone David T. Cole, and I'm here with Giblet Shower Sarah D. Bunting.
Must be Wednesday.
Manic Pusher Dream Girl Tara Ariano.
I'm all about consent.
And Pair of Fireballs Nick Reinwell Jones.
Sponsored by Gold Bond Medicated Powder.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. We will get to our guest in just a second, but first we have a little pod business up top. Once again, the Canon / Nonat cupboard is nearly bare. If you have held off submitting because you're worried you have to assemble the whole thing yourself, including the clips, you don't. You just record you and tell us the time codes for your clips. Dave will put it all together for you. And also, if you're thinking, but I sent mine and you haven't done it yet, we have a few earmarked for a special episode in December that we are actually recording tomorrow. So don't worry, we will get to yours. Either way, whether you're a submitter new or old, you get a dang free through methods shirt of your choice for your submission. So that is how we thank you. It's a pretty good deal. So all the information you need is at extrahotgreat.com/submissions. So get in there.
Let's check it out, Chewbacca.
Our guest is a creator of immersive experiences that you've heard with us here many times before. It's Nick Reinwell Jones.
Woo!
Nick!
Yay! Hello. Lovely to be back.
Nick is back to help us discuss Gen V. It's a spinoff of The Boys, in which Godalkin University, God U for short, so subtle as The Boys verse tends to be, it's the feeder school for superheroes and the people who want to manage them and or act in movies and TV shows with them. Our POV character is Marie, Jazz Sinclair, whose power to control her blood and the blood of others came on upon, what else, her first period. After the deaths of her parents, she was raised in foster care, so she needs God U to work. Her roommate Emma, Lizzie Broadway, can shrink down to various sizes, but not without a personal physical cost. God U's leading lights all have secret pain to deal with. Andre, Chance Perdomo, who can control metal, has to carry the expectations of his soup father polarity, Sean Patrick Thomas from Save the Last Dance. There's also Jordan, who can change size and gender at will, played by London Thor and Derek Liu. Jordan is trying to forge their own path separate from their parents' shame about their gender expression. Luke, Patrick Schwarzenegger, yes, of that Schwarzenegger family, is already going by the handle Golden Boy, and to keep him on track to the Seven, secrets are being kept from him. First three episodes dropped last Friday on Prime Video. We got six, but we will be mindful of plot spoilers for the rest. Let's do the Chen check-in. Nick, should our listeners watch Gen V?
Yes, and I'd even say hell yes.
All right, Sarah.
Yeah, I mean, if you are a Boys Verse consumer, you will enjoy this. And if you're not, then you are safe to leave this where it is. But it's all the things that The Boys does well and all the other things, too.
Dave.
Yeah.
I agree.
I'm into it as well.
So let's get into our discussion with spoilers. In my review at Cracked, which we will link in the show notes, I wrote that a show like The Boys is always going to be at risk of maxing out escalation, which is why I think it is so smart that this one kind of goes backwards in its first real spinoff, not counting that animated thing that they did. And it's focusing on characters that have less power, less confidence, less security. Nick, how did the change of setting work for you?
I actually think it's a perfect transition from the excesses of The Boys, which is definitely, it's a show I like, but it's also, a show that feels the need to keep topping itself. And it ultimately becomes kind of like so chaotic that I sort of forget what happens between seasons, even though I'm into it. But with this, they've kind of perfectly, dialed it back a little bit and, given it a big boost of sort of like post-Whedon energy. It's definitely got like much more of like a Scooby Gang vibe than The Boys does. And also, it doesn't feel the need to like dwell so hard in the realm of just like cynicism and like everything is fucked and who cares, mm-hmm. where the boys can sort of get to a point where you're like, is it worth saving anything? I don't know. In this one, they are actually willing to sort of cling to an idea of like good versus evil. And I think it's better for that. And I was really, really into it.
Sarah, you were nodding. You agree.
I do. I thought that your review at Cracked was spot on and that the part of the appeal of this franchise generally is that they do game out all of the world building to like the logical and illogical end. So as deranged as it might be to be dealing with like the sex, like the sexual politics of being a freshman in college, mm-hmm. under normal circumstances, they really think through like, what would this be like for someone whose ability to shrink down is being fetishized by a 19-year-old boy, yeah. fellow soup, like that they're willing to go there even when it's just like scabrously disgusting or hilariously raunchy. Like that's part of what I love about it is that they will build out to the edges of whatever world it is. And that's also why I think Gen V is a sort of breath of fresh cynical air for the franchise is because they can now sort of build a different world while still talking about their cynicism about how everything is branded in every universe. It's still pertinent, but it's also like it can be exhausting. Like you said, like there is this escalation with the parent show. So I did like this chance to reset, but it was still the same kind of scabrous too muchness that The Boys has, which mm-hmm. I also enjoy when The Boys is on, and then when it's off, it's like, phew.
Yeah.
Like,
yes.
I'm relieved that the season is over, and I don't have to pick chunks of someone out of my hair.
Yes.
Metaphorically.
Or my stonework. Before I throw to Dave for his initial thoughts, I just wanted to note, in terms of the setting in a physical sense, if you looked at those blocky campus buildings and thought, those have to have been built on a computer screen. Wrong! They are real. That is the Mississauga campus of the University of Toronto. So shout out U of T. I am an alumna. Dave, what did you think?
I think this show could have been called Gross Hogwarts. And I'm not bad at it.
Yeah.
There is an opportunity here for more personal stories within the confines of this disgusting, gross, ultraviolet universe in which we all live in. So that is the wrinkle to this that doesn't just make it more boys. It's got its own framework that is different enough that I feel like it justifies itself as a show mm-hmm. rather being... Yeah. angry students who kill each other at a school rather than in a city or whatever, which it could have been easily. So far, so good. You know, in the first three episodes, pretty solid, gross in the same ways that The Boys can get gross. I don't really know if they're going to top the guy exploding in some other guy's penis.
Mm-hmm. From The Boys.
But yeah, they sure did try with this one. Mm-hmm. I enjoy those moments. Obviously, we're going to talk about plot points of the first three episodes. They're mm-hmm. there to watch, but spoilers, ahoy, and all that kind of stuff.
Spoilers, ahoy.
The way which Golden Boy explodes as sort of the end of the first episode. Just that there's like little chunks of him between the concrete blocks mm-hmm. of the quad and everything. Just something so gushy and disgusting and familiar all at the same time.
Yes.
It really took me back to living in New York for some reason, where you'd be walking down like Columbus Avenue and be like, what's that? I don't know, but I'm not finding out. Sidestep.
Is that dog
wide
poo?
Birth. Mm. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
How organic is that? Mm-hmm. Slightly or very? Don't want to know.
Yeah, and the fact that like they... Then in the second episode, it's not like, you know, I feel like in the Marvelverse, there's always some kind of like, you know, black suited team that like comes on. But mm-hmm. here it's like, nope, just regular school janitors like scooping up the chunks.
But it's true. So, Sarah, you and I have watched a lot of teen dramas set at college. Did you find yourself watching this and just musing, what would have been different for Brenda Walsh at the University of Minnesota if she could have just sliced her palms open and killed Darla Hanson with her blood whips?
I was not thinking that necessarily.
Okay, Felicity. But, then.
Yeah. Hey. Yeah, I thought that this did a good job. College is such a difficult prospect for TV because you kind of like you're in a tough position where if you're taking it seriously, like who takes themselves more seriously than college freshmen and sophomores?
Right.
Nobody. So it's sort of difficult from a writing standpoint to like take your character seriously, but also acknowledge that they're, you know, when they go home for Thanksgiving, they're going to be super annoying. Mm-hmm. We all were.
Well, super, super annoying in this case.
Yes, exactly. No regular annoying for God, you, Frosh. But this, I think, did a good job. This universe can struggle a little bit by tipping too far into the, do you get it? Do you get what we're satirizing thing sometimes? But I thought it showed a relatively, for this universe, light touch in sort of getting after the pretensions of college students that are universal even for people with these powers and talents. And it didn't go too hard on that, probably because it was going too hard on social media and cancellation and stuff like that. So, you know, I think that sometimes the things that it has a light touch with are because it's going too far with other stuff, but that's just this universe and you sort of learn to live with it because they're trying to do something. And most of the time it's pretty entertaining.
Well, you say sometimes they're heavy handed, but then you have people that are like, wait a second, Homelander's a bad guy? You know, like these are things like where it's like,
it's true.
Yes. Mm. And yes, they're all Nazis. What? Like,
yeah. Or you have someone in the writer's room.
I forgive it. Some of it's signposting.
Yeah.
Yeah. True.
Watching this show definitely made me think like, boy, am I glad I'm not going to college in the year of our Lord 2023, because like, God, I'm sure it really is like that, especially if you imagine going somewhere like Juilliard and people probably are like, yep, I've already got a million followers. I'm represented. What are you doing? You know? Yeah. I think they blend that really well, even better than they blended in the regular Boys universe with all the branding and stuff like that. The recruitment video is so hilariously spot on.
Oh my God. Amazing.
Not to get into, you know, too much spoilers again, but like, I think all of that stuff, they sort of get through well in like the first couple episodes, and then they're not as much dwelling in that, you know, look at us space. I think they do a good job of just getting straight into storytelling and mystery and stuff like that in a way that you might, you know, not the way that I wasn't even necessarily expecting them to. Like, it really has an amazing through line, I think, once they just sort of establish the characters and ground the world and everything.
Yeah. Well, and the branding is sort of like, it's almost the inciting incident of our Golden Boy explosion, like truly, because some kids do some dumb kid shit. They sneak out to a bar, they get into trouble, a woman gets killed by accident, and then Marie has to take the fall because she is the perfect fall guy. Like, as Brink, the professor played by Clancy Brown in a too small role, I'm going to say, personally, he's like, all of these five superstars already have their futures mapped out, or four, I guess, but you are never going to go anywhere. Your power is too disgusting. Like, you have to be expelled. We're blaming this on you. And then that's sort of the, you know, that's where it takes a turn and then leads them to discover the bigger secret that's being kept, you know, in the basement at the school. So that part of it was interesting too, where it's like, as Sarah was saying earlier about, you know, thinking through everything to its logical conclusion, like a company this big has to control everything, like absolutely everything from stem to stern. And like, it reminds you that stuff is happening in the Boys verse that has not gotten out to the larger world. Like, there's stuff that, you know, they reference people, characters from that show, and there's stuff they don't know that we know because we watch the show.
Yeah, it's an interesting combo of superhero story meets company town.
Yes.
Cursed kind of villain, you know, in the shadows, in the background that we haven't seen yet. Yeah. And it works. Obviously, in the Boys, we've seen it, you know, like Bot is everything. They do everything from manage superheroes to make breakfast cereal to they are the Marvel Studios of their universe and everything. And we get little tastes of how deep that goes in Gen V as well. So I'm interested to see just how far they take it, because like, they don't seem to actually make room for anybody else in the narrative. Like, it seems like Bot just is like the corporation of the world in this universe. And there's really nothing else going on.
Yeah. And that's why, well, I, you know, I don't think this is like a significant spoiler, but there is an episode that involves a fundraiser. And I was like, why do they need a fundraiser in this world? Don't they control the entire consumer economy?
Yeah, I wondered the same thing. I think also that the acting is better than it needs to be given the premise. And I think that really helps the premise sustain, even when what Dave called the signposting, which perfect, is really, you know, blatant. And it's fascinating that they can cast, like, there's a certain kind of Nepo baby that they cast that provides this wonderful, like, meta commentary. My question to the group is, now that they have found two perfect hybrids of their famous parents for each version of the franchise, mm-hmm. like, they have Jack Quaid in The Boys, they have Patrick Schwarzenegger in this one, like, who... Is there some Brolin that has a famous mom that looks exactly like, and then they're going to be in, like, I don't know, Vought Babies or whatever the next spinoff is? Mm-hmm. Because there was something really creepy about watching this exact hybrid of Arnold and a fucking Kennedy with those fucking teeth in this role, that it was just like all these dark, twisted American corrupt brands coming together and then exploding in a shower of giblets. Like, yes. That's your commentary. You really don't have to do anything else. You just cast that guy.
Patrick Schwarzenegger, to me, in this really has like that Cracker Jack lenticular prize thing where it's like, oh, Arnold, oh, Maria. Oh, yeah. And I could not see them both at once.
Yeah.
Like, there was something about it where it's just one angle. It's like, oh, that's the son of Arnold Schwarzenegger. Oh, no, wait, that's the son of, but not together. Like, it was weird.
Right.
Yeah. Jack Quaid sort of is different and nests out to Pacey Witter.
Yeah.
That you're like, so he looks like, he looks like Quaid. He looks like Meg Ryan. He looks like Joshua Jackson. When are we?
Yeah.
Disconcerting.
You could do a deep dive on him, Sarah, possibly for a podcast called Quaid in Half. I'm just saying.
That's pretty good. I'm going to say Maya Hawk, although she really looks more like Uma than Ethan.
Yeah.
Billy Lord could be dropped in there for sure, too.
Oh, yeah. Yes. For sure. Yes.
Although she arguably only has one famous parent and just one super rich parent. Yeah.
So what did we think of the rest? Chance Perdomo, Blaise Andre, kind of got in some social media hot water this week, his own self.
Really?
Yeah, he was liking tweets about Andrew and Andrew Tate. He's like an Andrew Tate fan, apparently an anti-vaxxer. And then he was like, oops, I was using AI account management and I'm not going to do that anymore.
AI is the new dehydration rehabilitation.
Yes, exactly. Completely.
Dehydrated and exhausted.
But unfortunately, I thought he was pretty good. What did the rest of you think?
He's the least interesting superhero of the Scooby gang, though.
We've seen him do his power the least, for sure.
Yeah. Cricket is fun. It's Emma, who shrinks when she barfs.
Yeah.
And she purges, which is bad for her. And then there's a character who I don't know the last name, but I've been calling her Kate Gloves.
The pusher.
Yeah, the mesmerizer, but also has to wear gloves like
just the Kilgrave.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like Rogue and X-Men. Mm-hmm. And you know by season two there's gonna be like six more in the Scooby gang.
Well, we meet more and more even as the series goes on.
Yep.
Like in the next three episodes that were provided for critics. And it also gives more of an insight. This is not really spoilery, but like we see more about the infrastructure of God U within Vought and how it's part of like not just the Seven strategy, but an overall media strategy. There's a sort of like a Keith Morrison type comes to school to do a report about the Golden Boy killing, and he has his own issues, and that's probably the funniest storyline of the early part of the season. So yeah, I felt like other than Clancy Brown, which I feel, you know, we could have gotten more of him. He is delightful.
Well, hear me
always
out.
Yes.
Watching that made me think, if Lucasfilm decides to recast Ray Stevenson's character in Ahsoka, I think Clancy Brown can do it if one, you ignore the fact that Clancy Brown actually had a cameo in the first episode.
I thought I saw it.
Two, you care because that show is not good except for Ray Stevenson.
True. Yeah, fair. The only other thing I was going to say is like, it's, you know, I come to this franchise for magic, of course, but also for extremely graphic violence. And there was a lot of that. We get, you know, the initial blood kill with Marie, incredible. The Golden Boy explosion, we've already discussed. Yeah. The mishap with a quarter-turned metal hummingbird turned weapon of tiny destruction, punching a guard right up from his abdomen and out his mouth. That was pretty amazing. So, and then, you know, killing a guard by walking straight through his brain. Yes, I'm here for all of this. Good
and
job.
Something, that we won't spoil, but is, hoo boy.
Yeah.
You'll know it when you see it.
You sure will.
All right, it's time to go around the dial. First up is with Tara.
Hello! Last week when Brittany was here, I mentioned I had written about Still Up, the new rom-com on Apple TV+. And while I was doing that, trying to put my finger on why that TV rom-com didn't work, I kept thinking about what another TV rom-com does right. That show was Starstruck, which runs in this country on Max. It's not only that Still Up is not that funny, although it's not, or that it's impossible to tell whether leads have chemistry because they're never together until late in the season. And I know that's because the male lead is agoraphobic, but nothing is stopping the female lead from just going over to his place to hang out. And the fact that she never does is one of the many things the show never thinks to explain. Whereas Starstruck is very funny. Its leads have great romantic and comedic chemistry. Each episode feels like it has a reason to exist as a TV episode, telling a distinct story on its own that contributes to a season arc, but can also stand separate. The first season was about the protagonists, Jesse, played by Rose Matafeo, who also created it, and Tom, Nikesh Patel, figuring out they did want to be together. The second season was about them being together, despite their very different stations in life. And the third is about them being apart, but figuring out if that's how they're going to stay. And I don't want to say too much more about it because it is a great season and I don't want to spoil it. But ahead of the third season premiere in the UK, Matafeo gave an interview with The Guardian where she talked about feeling a lot of guilt about making a rom-com since the genre has historically been based on selling particularly women false ideas about love. And I definitely think the third season goes the furthest in showing the difference between just having a relationship as a normal human adult and driving toward attaining a relationship as though it was your only concern in life, which I think is what Matafeo's worried Starstruck might seem to be to some. But I rewatched the first two seasons ahead of the third, which is, by the way, very fast to do. Episodes are a tight 20-ish minutes. There are only six in each season. And the show has always been very thoughtful and intentional in A, knocking down fairy tale tropes, and B, showing a bunch of different ways to be in a relationship or not. And so, for my plug, I wrote about everything Starstruck does right. That's at Cracked. We'll link it in the show notes. And the Guardian interview, if you want to read that as well, is linked in my piece, and you should. She is very thoughtful.
All right, Nick, what do you have for us?
Well, apparently my timing on this could not be better, since both of the last two game times are based on the show I'm about to talk about, and that is Only Connect, the British quiz show that has captured my heart and mind over the past year. And I promise you, if you give it a chance, you will probably fall in love with it as well. I'm aware that there are enough British quiz shows out there for pretty much everyone on Earth to have their own unique favorite, but Only Connect truly stands out, and here's why. First of all, it is perfect for playing along at home. The questions are difficult almost beyond belief, but that means you get to feel incredibly smart if you can get even a couple of them on any given show. And there's a solid chance that you will, because the question writers are really good at diversifying the material. So if you're not up on your 19th century British prime ministers, you can still score some points by recognizing the years in which each Back to the Future film takes place.
Lord Palmerstone!
The Elder!
The first round of each game closely resembles the aforementioned game times. You get a maximum of four clues, and you have to identify the common thread among them. One of the questions is always the music question, aka the question everyone loves to hate, because it's usually very, very hard. You think you've identified a trend based on the song titles, but it turns out they were looking for runner-up bands in Eurovision. No, I'm not making that up. Apparently, British people really know Eurovision well. In the second round, you get a maximum of three clues that represent some kind of sequence, and you have to identify the missing fourth item in that sequence. Again, sometimes these questions are very satisfying, like when you recognize that they're looking for actors who played Bond villains in reverse chronological order, and sometimes they make you want to throw the remote at the screen as you curse your insignificant knowledge of snooker champions. The third round is the connecting wall. And if you've recently played the New York Times connections game, yep, the old gray lady just plain ripped that off from Only Connect. Mm-hmm. It's 16 clues on a board that can be arranged into four thematic groups. And this part is ideal for playing along at home because you can just pause the show as soon as they unveil the board, try your hand at sorting the clues until you give up and see how the players do. Final stage is a lightning round of words, names, and phrases with all the vowels taken out. And after all the deep thinking during the earlier parts of the show, it's fun and cathartic to just yell answers at the screen rapid fire. But despite all the game mechanics that are great, what really makes Only Connect a winner is its host, Victoria Corin Mitchell. You may know her as a highly entertaining cast member in season 12 of Taskmaster, but she shines even more brightly on her home turf inside a minimalist studio in Cardiff with no studio audience and six contestants who are inevitably among the dorkiest humans ever to be filmed. I'm not saying it's obvious that most of these people have never been on TV before. I am saying it's possible that some of them have never been in a brightly lit room before. And yet the host never acts like she's above them in any way, unlike some Trebeks we've known. Instead, she takes every opportunity to make fun of her own nerdiness and her many trivia blind spots, while also throwing in frequent references to how much she drinks. If you can watch more than a few episodes of Only Connect without developing at least a platonic crush on Victoria, you might be made of stone. BT dubs, she's also made millions of dollars by destroying men at professional poker. You can find hundreds of episodes of Only Connect on YouTube. It's currently in its 19th season, and here's hoping its geeky delights never come to an end. I don't have anything particular to plug at the moment. My immersive entertainment company, Spy Brunch, is developing something very exciting here in Los Angeles, but it's not quite ready to announce. So I will just say, please support the Extra Hot Great Patreon. These people work really hard to keep you entertained. And speaking as a fellow entertainer, most of us aren't looking to get rich off our work. We just want enough money to keep doing it. So please consider pitching in. As usual, you can find me on all the socials, including Blue Sky at Reinhold Jones.
Charity buddy.
Hello, I'm here to talk about Feud, finally. The first season of this Ryan Murphy-Ian Brennan deep dive into great kerfuffles of 20th century pop culture is one of those things that was clattering around on the list for years because I didn't, quote, have to watch it. But then it moved up the list when the season two topic was announced, Truman Capote and his decision to burn down his social life with Lacoste Basque 1965. I know more about Capote's life than I need to. Yes, Capote basically created the true crime genre with In Cold Blood, but I've read entire books about the black and white ball, and that has no bearing on true crime at all. But anyway, I read the casting for the second season and was knocked the fuck out. I mean, Naomi Watts as Babe Paley, perfect. Diane Lane as Slim Keith, perfect. Sevigny as CZ Guest, perfect. Tom Hollander as Capote himself, perfect, 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 all the way down the line, can't wait. You could argue that really this season should be about Capote's feud with Gore Vidal, but A, that period of Capote's life is much, much more depressing from a substance misuse struggle standpoint, and B, it's not nearly as interesting from a costume design standpoint. In any event, that was my in to the first series, and the first season is just stunning to look at, very well acted, just as perfectly cast. And it really seems to get at why we as a culture come back to these stories, not just the gossipy aspect, not just the Schadenfreude, although those things play a role, but that specific straining to see a time gone by through a foggy window. I don't really know how else to put it. I did find it instructive to think about how Ryan Murphy et al. Create these atmospheres and build these worlds when compared to American Horror Story or to the monster subset of American Crime Story, which I think is also prioritizing the evocative over the respectful. I get what is being attempted there to try to bring the audience back to a time and a feeling via a true crime story, and I don't think it's entirely unsuccessful. I think Crime Story Season 2 was formally daring and really did something new and worthwhile in terms of using atmosphere to get at a truth. But I think it's also a fine line, and once you get into serial killers and cannibalism, once you're over that line, you need to just not do it. Anyway, I love that this group of people makes creative and thought-provoking content, even when it doesn't quite work slash probably should be killed off before it reaches the airwaves, so to speak. I sell a lot of Capote content at my true crime bookshop. Hey, that's at exhibitbbooks.com. You listeners can snag 15% off your order if you enter code EXHG15 at checkout. And in the show notes, there will be a link straight to that code if you want to click on it. And on top of that, paperbacks are on sale for the next 2 weeks. Every paperback, new ones, old ones, rare ones, crappy ones I have 5 copies of. It's all on sale for the next 2 weeks. And like I said, link in the show notes.
All right, here's what's coming up in the Extra Hot Great universe on the next Extra Extra Hot Great this Friday. It is Found. Hey, what's network TV doing? They're doing Found. That's what they're doing. We'll discuss missing persons show, plus an extra credit about replacing TV sound effects we find not quite the best, and we'll make some suggestions on how to make them perfect. That plus Ask ESG and all the other regular segments. Go to extrahotgreat.com/club to join today if you haven't. And then right here next week on ESG Prime, we're talking the Kane Mutiny court-martial, and we're welcoming back Tim Grierson to talk about that. Don't miss it next week. Oh, and by the way, I almost shouted over you, but didn't when you said, when you were doing your Oni Connect thing about snooker. I was going to say Pot the Elder, but didn't have time. It is time for the Extra Hot Great Canon. Presenting this week is Sarah D. Bunting. Take it away, Sarah.
Yeah, it's me. Hello. Today, I would like to propose Veronica Mars Season 1, Episode 1 for induction into the Extra Hot Great canon. There's only one Veronica Mars episode in the canon currently. That's Season 3's Spit and Eggs, submitted by, if I'm not mistaken, our guest today, Nick Reinwell-Jones, back in Episode 85. I'm not shocked exactly that there aren't more episodes of this show in the canon, or that more haven't at least been attempted in the past. The show is serialized enough and consistent enough in quality that I understand how it might seem canon-resistant, for lack of a better term. I am a little shocked, though, that this specific episode hasn't come under canon consideration yet. I do think it merits induction, and here is why. Number one, it's easy to forget this nearly 20 years on, but the show was a genre buster. In case you were not a fan or just don't recall the premise, well, actually, the titular Veronica just jumps right in with the scene-setting voiceover at the top of the episode, so let's let her handle at least part of it. Clip one.
This is my school. If you go here, your parents are either millionaires or your parents work for millionaires. Neptune, California, a town without a middle class. If you're in the second group, you get a job. Fast food, movie theaters, mini-marts. Or you could be me. My after-school job means tailing philandering spouses or investigating false injury claims.
They had me, and then they had me. Veronica Mars, played by Kristen Bell, is a high school private eye. She pitches in at her disgraced ex-sheriff father Keith's, Enrico Colantoni, small PI concern in corrupt Neptune, California, while also taking on cases of the week for classmates and trying to figure out what became of her mom, who left town after Keith's reputation went into the shitter. And by the way, that happened because he may have tried to railroad software magnate Jay Kane, Kyle Secor, for the murder of his daughter Lily, Amanda Seyfried, who was Veronica's best friend. And Jake's son Duncan, Teddy Dunn, was Veronica's boyfriend but broke up with her shortly before Lily's murder, which Veronica is also reinvestigating, even though somebody who is not Jake Kane is already sitting on death row for committing it. Veronica would also like to find out who drugged and raped her at a party the year prior, an incident that has somehow stuck to her in the form of a, quote, easy rep. Clip two.
You get lonely out here, remember. Weaver love you long time.
Quite a reputation I've got, huh? You want to know how I lost my virginity? So do I.
Woof. So, yeah, there's a lot going on. Much of it is real dark. But in 2004, this wasn't something we had really seen on TV before, this blend of WB teen drama and California noir. I think the debut episode of a unique genre mashup is worth considering for the canon in terms of its broader significance for TV. Number two. You know that laundry list of backstory I just reeled off for you? The Veronica Mars pilot has to set up all of that for slash as the season's overarching set of mysteries and balance it with a case of the week, which here involves helping new student Wallace Fennell, Percy Daggs III, who begins his tenure at Neptune High duct-taped to a flagpole for allegedly snitching on motorcycle gangsters for shoplifting 40s. The show always had a pretty good feel for that balance. A lot of the material was pretty bleak, like I said, but generally episodes furnish a functional mix of the heavy corruption of the season arc case and the usually lighter cases of the week that would make up the credible bulk of a teenage PI's caseload. And there's enough pop culture-infused snark in the dialogue to keep the show from bogging down in its characters' respective traumas. As here, when Veronica love-hate interest Logan Eccles, Jason Doring, is menacing her car after she set him up during a locker search. Clip 3.
Suddenly feel like I'm in a scene from The Outsiders.
Be cool, soda pop.
Number 3. The show is processy. The private investigator as aspirational character is a surefire draw for process slash tradecraft nerds like myself. PIs get to be nosy, but also operate outside the strictures of the law slash policing. In this episode alone, we see Veronica switching out key evidence via a Rube Goldbergian setup that also gets her harasser Logan in trouble, staking out Jake Kane at the local no-tell motel, and leveraging her intimate knowledge of a sheriff department employee's accent and ongoing IT struggles to get license plates run for her own devices. It's particularly compelling to see a young woman private eyeing, partly because it subverts a noir trope by positioning the private dick as the blonde, but partly because even in the Buffy and post-Buffy era, it was unusual and rad to see a tough teenage girl problem-solving at the center of a well-constructed, concentric set of mysteries. But as smart as creator Rob Thomas and his team were about starting from an intriguing logline, none of it works without number 4, Kristen Bell. Her public persona in the last decade is not everyone's favorite, and I get it, but you can't really argue with the idea that she owned the Veronica role from the jump, and you can't really overstate the degree of difficulty involved here. Bell has to portray both the cynical current Veronica and the pre-lapsarian naive of the flashbacks, who is also saddled with a not-great wig, not for nothing. She has to give us enough hard-boiled tone that we're interested, but not so much that it's not relatable. And she has to navigate between flip and super dark. And she has to do that in scene and in voiceover, sometimes in the same scene. It's really not something that I can clip, unfortunately. But Kristen Bell is very good at projecting a certain formidability as Veronica that belies her tiny stature. That taser helps, of course, and that, quote, technology makes its glorious debut in this pilot also, but part of the key to this character, and thus to the audience investing in the show, is that you seldom feel that she's in any genuine peril, despite various situations being pretty dangerous on their faces. But sometimes, Belle as Veronica flinches away from an adversary or an impact, as she does when a spoiled, furious, foot taller than her Logan is fucking up her LeBaron with a tire iron, and you're reminded that this is, in the end, still a child, a petite girl who has lost almost everything. Not all the acting is great in this first episode. I used to have a podcast called Go Pirates with our esteemed colleague John Ramos. We had an It's Log sound drop, and we used it early and often. But the pilot does seem to know how to play to its strengths in that regard. Reed doesn't give Dunn too much to do, including Amanda Seyfried, who is immediately and utterly charming as the late Lily Kane, and that threatening exasperation that is Frances Capra as Weevil. But 85% of this lift is on Kristen Bell's back in two timelines, and she lifts the hell out of it. I had the Veronica Mars pilot on the syllabus in my TV survey course from a few years back, and the student's response was kind of a microcosm of the contemporary reaction to the show. A couple of them adored it intensely. The rest of the class thought it was kind of corny, kind of a who cares-er. I was a little surprised by that at first, but actually it does make a kind of sense because they'd seen it done before. They didn't know how rare it was for a network show. They also hadn't spent years in the recapping trenches with C-plus at best teen shows and didn't necessarily appreciate how difficult a pilot like this is to pull off or how easy the creator and the star made it look. I know this presentation is kind of elliptical, but I think this is probably an if you know, you know prospect. So let's get into the discussion and you can tell me if I missed anything. We did used to be friends, after all, a long time ago. And if you've thought of this show lately at all, I hope you'll put it in the canon.
Sarah, thank you so much. Nick, you selected this. Please start our discussion. You're also the expert, having gotten the previous episode
yes.
in, so who better?
Yeah. I'm feeling okay. I'm feeling good.
So I'll be honest. I mean, I've certainly have considered submitting this one for the canon in the past. I think I would almost put it a little bit in like the shooting fish in a barrel category, because it's like mm-hmm. almost like so obviously a canon candidate. And yeah, I mean, I remember watching it when it premiered. I was in the tank for it right away. I have almost the same note as you said of like Kristen Bell just owns the screen as soon as she steps on. And I remember already having seen her on like in a just couple scene role on an episode of The Shield, and remembering that like she was already great in that. She was playing like a gang member's girlfriend, I think. So I already sort of like I vaguely knew who she was before she started. But one thing that I realized watching this and watching Gen V in the same week is that they both pull off something that I think is really important and really hard on a show like this, where it's about sort of what's the right amount of like peril to put younger people in
yeah.
that feels right. like there's stakes, but also feels, you know, that doesn't feel, you know, cheesy, like, you know, Hermione, oh no, we might get expelled, like, but also not right. like you're just, you know, like kids are getting shot at every day. Like,
right.
and I think both of these really thread the needle well, where, yeah, like, you know, in either, you know, when she's being harassed by Logan or by Weevil or whatever, you're like, oh, I'm scared for this character, but then I also believe that she has the resources to, you know, to mm-hmm. to take care of herself and stuff. I've even rewatching it now, I think I expected it to feel a little more dated than it did, and it really didn't to me. I think there are things about it that you can that are, you know, of its era. It's visually flashy in a way that like shows just aren't now, even though they are flashy in other ways. But I think you also have to remember that in 2004, a lot of people were still watching TV on small boxy screens. So if you wanted to do anything, you know, sort of like visually interesting, you could not be subtle about it. It had to be like, boom, here it is. And right. now, you know, that people know everyone's watching on like 65 inch high definition screens, you can go a little more like cinema subtle. But yeah, no, I think it's like you said, Sarah, it's incredible how much they set up while doing an actual, you know, not just one, but like multiple single episode stories. It's the kind of show where I had to like pause it at a certain point to be like, how long was that? Because they got so much in, and it was like 15 minutes. They've done so much mm-hmm. with backstory and current story and everything. Yeah, I think it's absolutely, you know, it's an amazing show in retrospect, but it was amazing from the jump.
I'll go next. I don't know if the target market of this show is watching TV on a 65-inch screen. I think they're watching on their laptop screens or their phones more often than not, but your point is taken about the visual interest of it. Yeah, this is one of the, I would say, all-time great pilots, because it does have to deliver so much exposition. It can't just sort of drop you in the middle and hope that you get it, and just because of how complex the story is. And even so, it does have that noir feeling of the way it brings you along, like this is a yarn you're gonna want to hear, and you want to see it play out. And she, you're absolutely right, both of you, that she's, you know, she's not my favorite as a person or a personality, but she is, you truly cannot imagine any other person playing this part. As soon as you see her in the very first scene, like, she pulls a knife in the first minute to cut mm-hmm. Wallace down. Like, she's so cool and yet so vulnerable at the same time. Like, you do believe she has the tools to look after herself, but you also get the sense just from how she performs it and how other people react to her, I mean, Cliff and others, the cops, that lessons have been learned before we met her. Like, she's mm-hmm. she's had situations, like, maybe not go bad in a physical way, but like, she's had to adjust her, she's gotten here by trial and error, and you don't feel that she's invulnerable. Do you just feel that she's like really extremely cool and capable and the exact person who should be doing this job with her dad, honestly? Having watched later shows that Rob Thomas was involved in, I did like the John Enbaum reference in the early part of the episode. He's a producer, co-creator of Party Down. That was cute. When Nick said it didn't look dated, true overall, not so the fashion. Her in her pink American Apparel ringer tee.
American Eagle. Yeah.
That's a moment in time right there, walking sure down was. The hall in her like chunky boots with her jeans just pooled around her ankles. Like, we all did it. I was old at this point.
Yeah, my wife Alexis referred to her haircut as Ashley Simpson hair and or Sweet Home Alabama hair.
Yeah. Absolutely right. That is correct on both counts. What sells us is like we need to believe that both of the Marses have a good reason for staying in town despite everything that happened to them. And in this, after the end of this pilot, you're like, we get it. We know why they are. And thank God they are, honestly. And then my last comment, I'll just say before passing it off to Dave, is I never noticed watching this the first time. Backup has huge balls. They're so big.
Yeah. he got recast. That wasn't why, but that wasn't not why.
Yeah. Get that dog neutered. Come on, guys. Dave. Yeah.
I couldn't really decide whether this pilot was extremely efficient in telling a lot of story or overpacked. I felt like at the end of it, I was like, oh, that was a little too much. I feel like they could have saved some stuff for episode two and let it breathe a little bit more as an introduction to everything that's going on. That attitude might change. I mean, that question mark might change the more that you watch. But watching this in isolation, I was like, that was fast. And I kind of wish they slowed down at certain points as they were telling it. I did love the beach noir of it all. I think that is something that feels very particular to this show and the mix of it, where you're like, there's always an In-N-Out burger just off camera. I can feel it. And dark things are happening there. Like that tone that they set, I thought was very effective. And you're right, like Kristen Bell, you really can't see anybody else inhabiting that. I love Keith Mars, the dad here. You know, he's written in a way that is very approachable and very believable and very TV at the same time. Mm-hmm, you know, like it lives in our world and their world. And I kind of would believe he could walk in both of them. It is intriguing, everything they did set up, but I just felt it was like just a little overpacked. And I think sometimes when I'm speaking from experience, but I think there's a compulsion when you're doing a pilot to make sure you sell everything the show's about there, because you're selling the show with the pilot, right? It is a product unto itself that you're showing to somebody and saying, please give me more money to continue this. And with that in mind, I understand why there was so much in there. Mm-hmm. Like I might have moved like the rape question to episode two or something, to let the rest of it have a little more breathing room, because I like parts of it that I thought were very funny as well. Like when the principal opens up her locker in the random checks and the only thing in there is a picture of him and a big heart. Mm-hmm. That was really funny.
Yeah.
And I felt like more school moments like that, I kind of would appreciate it.
Yeah.
But these are like minor nitpicks. Obviously, this is a very strong pilot that's doing a lot of things right. And I think most of my problems with it are problems probably with the way TV was made back then.
I was going to say, it definitely is like, this was a pilot that was made as a proof of concept, like you said, versus so many shows now where you're like, it doesn't really get going until episode three, and you know they were sold straight through to pilots. They felt like they have the room to like stretch out. I mean, The Changeling is an example of that that we watched recently.
You put a gun to my head and said, what do you want, too fast or too slow? I'd probably go too fast.
Right.
Because at least they get to the fucking fireworks factory, right? Which the show did. So, all right, let's put this to the official vote. Nick Reinwell Jones, Veronica Mars pilot, canon worthy or not?
You betcha.
Tara?
I agree. And I also want to add, thank you for making me rewatch this, because I really felt like I was out on an island hating Logan, never getting over it, never approving of them as a couple, and seeing him in the pile, I'm like, I was right. He fucking sucked. Come at me. I don't care.
All right. I'll say yes too. So That means that Veronica Mars, Season 1, Episode 1, Pilot, you are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time to discover the winner and the loser of the week. Tara has this week's winner.
Well, the winner is Kevin James, and the reason is someone somehow in the way of memes, you cannot know how anything gets started, but someone found an old press shot from King of Queens where he is in character as Doug Heffernan, standing in the King of Queens kitchen with his hands in his pockets, sort of sheepishly like smiling at the camera. And it turned into a sensation on every social media platform I'm on where people were like, me when I whatever. Like, one of the funniest ones I saw was Travis Kelce when he asked Taylor Swift if she saw him make the touchdown. This is the kind of thing that happens. It's so funny. The picture is so cute. And the reason he's the winner of the week is that he also apparently could not avoid this meme and decided to use it to rebrand his current comedy stand-up tour as the double hands in the pocket, almost a smile tour, sheepishly coming to a city near you. And I say, good for him. That's really funny.
And loser of the week?
Talk about people who need a rebrand but are not listening to people who care about them. Linda Fairstein. She is the real-life New York DA who was wrong about a lot of things and is now taking Ava DuVernay and Netflix to court for defamation over her portrayal by Felicity Huffman at an ill-timed portrayal there in When They See Us, which, honestly, you should probably send that whole production a muffin basket. They could have been much meaner to you. Didn't happen. There's been a lot of wrangling over whether that proceeding was going to proceed, and we have heard recently that it's going ahead. So that's gonna yet another possible stranglehold that might be put on the creative process when it comes to nonfiction properties. Boo.
Speaking of being wrong about a lot of stuff, do you know what time it is?
Is it non-regulation game time?
Non-regulation game time.
It sure is. We finished a season last week. It is our tradition to do a non-regulation game time between game time seasons so that Dave gets to play and I am running it. And guess what, guys? It has been almost 8 months since our last Tube Tunes. So we're doing it again. Tube Tunes 13. Holy shit.
Oh my God.
So Dave is going to play a clip of an original song, or in one instance in this particular game, a pre-existing song with new lyrics from a TV show. If that's all you need to tell me what show the clip is from, you will earn 3 sweet points. However, because we're going to have actual stakes this time, the loser is required to buy the winner a gift valued at no more than $15 themed to one of the songs or shows the loser missed. I will note them, and we will tell you what is selected in a future episode. So since there's a prize at stake. Yes, Dave?
Prize is? I expect the winner should get 2 prizes, don't you think? There's 2 losers.
No, the last place finisher.
Okay.
I want to give you as many pointer tunities as possible. So if you need a hint, I will tell you the name of a cast member from the show. Then it's worth 2 points. If you still don't know, I'll give you a second cast member. Then it's just worth 1. No free guesses because that's a lot of hints. There is no show in the game more than once. We have 18 questions and a tiebreaker. None of the usual extra jazz. Is everyone ready to play Tube Tunes 13, lucky number 13 for spooky season?
No, because we need to find out who's going first.
Yes, let's throw it to Picky to see who's going first.
We will start with Sarah.
Okay, now are you ready?
Yes.
Our order is Sarah, Nick, Dave. Dave, please play Sarah, clip number 1.
Shake off your blues, I'll set the mood for ya.
Lights out.
Now sit right down, let your troubles melt away. You'll be sitting pretty in the moonlight gaze. We'll tumble through the tulips and dance on the graves of any motherfucker who gets in your way.
I need a hint, please.
Your first hint is Tawny Cypress.
Tawny Cypress. Tawny Cypress. Nope, it's still out of reach. Could I have another hint, please?
I think you're going to get it on this one. Christina Ricci.
Oh, Yellow Jackets.
Good for 1 point. Misty has a fantasia about it, her gray parrot singing that to her.
God, I forgot about that.
All right, next is Nick. Let's hear clip two.
Oh, old Bart the Buck had a dong on my long, had a dong on my long head. He tried to suck it on a tuffet.
Ah, what the hell did he do?
Oh, I will definitely take a hand here.
Your first in is a recurring cast member in many episodes, Sam Richardson.
Oh, is it I Think You Should Leave?
Yes, it is. Dirty Bachelor Party song.
geriatric
performer who forgets all the words. All right, clip three is for David T. Cole.
Sleep, baby artist. You're very, very tired. Sleep, baby artist, your pains have expired. You're breathing in tubes, we'll give you a bird.
No idea, I'll take a hint.
First hint is Jenny Eclair.
Don't know who that is. Second hint.
Mae Martin is your second hint.
Oh, is this Taskmaster?
Yes, it is Taskmaster for 1 point. Back to Sarah for clip four.
Congratulations, you the one boy. You sparked a light up on the world. We raised you to be a fighter. You shine just like a Jerry curl. You up the ante, make the whole world drop their panties. Cause
why bring your panties?
It's a metaphor.
Hint?
Your first hint is Walton Goggins.
That can't be. Why can't I remember the name of that show? While I'm stalling in my mind, could I have another hint, please?
Sure, your second hint is Jarrell Jerome.
Oh, shit. It's that thing that we just watched. And I don't remember the name of it.
No!
Damn it. I don't know.
Serious?
Sorry. Buzz me.
Dave got it.
I'm a Virgo. I had it on the first one. It was
yes!
Fine.
Fuck.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, Dave. All right, back to Nick for clip five.
Yeah, the children are our future. It ain't no debate. Play with a teacher's aid. I'ma catch a case. Better not be slipping or that's still you gon' be kissing. Pack my bastards. They was tripping. They won't be bumping in the kitchen. Play with a teacher, you finna get slapped. Don't got no rear, but you gon' get clapped. Put your hands up. Put those adult hands up. Yeah.
If I don't get mine right away when it comes, I'm going to be really angry with Biggie.
You might be angry. What is that, Nick?
Okay, well, I'm going to take a guess because this is a show that I have not watched as much as I should. Is it Abbott Elementary?
It is Abbott Elementary for 3 points.
Nice.
All right, Dave's about to be mad at me, I think. Let's hear clip six.
I've waited a lifetime for this night to see a midnight filled with light, to watch the comet cross the skies, to see the wonder in your eyes.
No, I've heard it. I'm going to take a wild stab at this one and probably regret it. Is it the Newsreader?
Yes!
Wow, nice.
Whoa.
Incredible. Every time we're watching something, anytime there's a song, I am on my phone because I have a running list. I'm sure I've said this before. And I always wondered, is Dave noticing me adding this episode to my list? All right.
Or if he's noticing, is he remembering?
No.
Exactly.
Neither is happening, trust me.
All right, back to Sarah for clip seven.
This thing we've been doing, it ain't working out. Why can't you just admit it to me?
make a good thing.
In.
Your first hint is Suki Waterhouse.
Nope. Hint.
Your next hint is Riley Keough.
Oh, God. That thing really fell right out of my head. Including the name of it, which I think is probably something like Daisy Jones and the Six.
Yeah, good for one point.
Oh, worked for that one.
Back to Nick, clip 8.
Nick, you got fucked there.
No, there's some clues at the end.
Oh, it's... I do feel like it's something that I've seen.
I bet you have.
Shit.
You can ask for a hint.
Yeah, I'll take
it. You got two. Your first hint is Fiona Shaw.
Fiona Shaw. Oh, is it Succession?
No. That's not her. That's Harriet Walter.
Right.
Killing, do you want killing Eve?
Stunt double.
It's not Killing Eve. Dave, I can't believe you didn't get that. That's fucking Andor when he's on Space Miami.
Whoa,
that's why there was a hint at the end where you could hear the drones going.
I've seen it, but
I would
it was
have guessed
not.
Samurai Jack if it that, makes anyone feel better.
You said Fiona Shaw. I thought my brain went, what is she in? That where?
Also, yeah, I barely even remember that she was in Andor, but yeah, no.
All right.
None's gone now.
I mean, she had a pretty important role, I would say. Especially in the finale. But anyway, let's clip 9 is for Dave, and then we'll get a score break.
We're just a guy with no ass in his ass. Assing it up under an asinine sky. Ass into the tumbleweeds as we ass by. Yodeling a cowboy tune, but not yet. People sass me on my ass as we pass. They say, wouldn't it be better if my ass rode me? They tell me I outweigh my ass by a factor of 3. So I punch him and I kick their yodel, yodel, day, hee, hoo.
All right. Well, that's definitely the voice of Bender.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's from Futurama or not because I don't recognize it. But I also didn't watch this new season after the first one because it fucked. What else has he? He's been in. Well, he could have been in anything, couldn't he? He's a voice actor. Now I'm trying to get into Tara's head. Doing a little marriage privilege. Mm-hmm. What else would?
Uh-huh.
I mean, could have, what else would she be clock? Fuck it, Futurama.
Correct for 3 points. You watched this episode. This was the last one where you before you were like, I think I'm good on this show.
Okay.
It's the one where they're in the Bitcoin mining town.
Okay.
All right, let's get a score break.
I don't remember that.
Well, after that last victory, mm-hmm. I have 2, Nick has 5, and Dave is in the lead with 7 points.
Oh boy. Ooh. Let's keep it going. Clip 10 is for Sarah D. Munting.
Remember the memories. Life is only
You got this one, Sarah.
I don't think I do, but I'm just going to have to guess. Because it seems like something that Archer would do. Okay.
What is it, Dave?
It's Clone High.
Yeah, it's Clone High.
Best friends forever.
That's all the foomps are things coming in and out of Gandhi's nose. All right, over to Nick, clip 11.
Yeah, they brand you a star. On the midnight train, going very far.
Midnight train,
light up, I give you a number. Shoot you down, throw you away. We will
Ooh, okay. I was headed in the very wrong direction at first, but then the last bit. Is that Party Down?
Yes, that's Party Down for Three
Wow.
Boys.
Oh, nice.
Retroactive content warning, I guess. It's very offensive lyrics, but that's the point of the scene.
That's the in context, yeah.
Kyle is dumb. He doesn't know. Clip 12 is for Dave.
She's smooth, like ice, cold to the touch, and it isn't very nice when you're left alone. Your lady treats you badly if you hang on the phone, take off. Shove your loving on the wheel, put the pedal to the floor, cause you're heading for the hills, gotta get away. Can't take it no more, man, you don't need this, leave her at the door.
The door, the door, the door.
Some authors use subtext. I call those authors cowards. That's Garth Marenghi's Dark Place.
It sure is for 3 points. I also want to alert everybody, this week's Lower Decks episode is titled Parth Ferengi's Heart Place, which I thought was really delightful.
Gorgeous.
It is.
Gorgeous.
All right, back to Sarah. Clip 13.
Merch girl, working all night. Merch girl, fits me just right. Merch girl, last one to leave. Merch girl, nothing up her sleeve. Yeah!
What the poker face.
Correct for 3 points. Was it the tiny bit of Benson at the end? Did you? Sounds like no. All right, Nick, clip 14 is for you.
The gays are racing home tonight, hurrah! Hurrah, our reunions we will crush tonight. Hurrah, hurrah. No one will be more successful than we. Or understand Kamala better than he. Cause we are gay and coming to win the night. Oh look, a third gay.
Such a stellar moment from the other two.
That is correct for 3 points. I'm going to give this to Dave and then we will have a score break. Clip 15.
You're my man, I'm gonna say you, cause I understand that you got the power. The right read says guaranteed, I'm gonna give you what you need. It's A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P. You are S, T, U, V, W, X, Y, Z.
Oh my god. Kind of familiar, but...
I think you've played this clip on the podcast before as an example of a moment.
Oh, I know it, I know it. I got it.
Yeah.
That is Al rapping from a super offensive episode of Quantum Leap.
Correct for 3 points.
What? Nice.
Nick, sadly, that is a fact. It is the season 3
and
finale.
I think...
Wow.
I think in the story... They kind of suggest that because of the time paradox,
yes.
Al created rap.
Correct. He's performing this for a black patient
in
a mental asylum.
Yeah. Okay. Oh
the only place where rap can truly be appreciated.
Yep. I remember that episode now. Yeah. Oof.
All right. Let's get them scores.
Well, Dave maintains his lead with 13, but Nick is not far off the pace with 11. I have 5.
Oh boy, this could change everything. Clip 16, you each have 1 question left. So maybe not forever. No, maybe not absolutely everything.
The real question is, who is Sarah buying the gift for?
Yeah, exactly. Let's hear clip 16 for Sarah.
Do you give me feels when I see them heels? Let's ride on a horse making love out in the fields, out in the field. Let me be your guy. Never mind them flies. Just get on the horse and
wait, hold on a second. All right.
Oh, I feel like I know it, but I need a hint.
Your first hint is Glenn Howerton.
It's probably ER.
Okay, that's not what I thought I knew, but let's try It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Correct. It's from the episode we watched for the canon. The post-COVID episode. Clip 17. Is for Nick.
Bring us your traumas, your latent neurosis.
Erectile dysfunction.
Bedwetting narcosis.
There's no need for shame. You can use a false name.
On our show.
Oh boy. That sounds familiar.
Does it help you that I know it?
Well, then I'm glad it's not your question.
Does it?
It's from Andor.
The best episode of Enterprise. I'm going to have to be conservative and take a hint.
Your hint is John Mahoney.
Ooh. Frasier?
Frasier wants a new theme song for his show, so he writes that, and it's extremely overwrought. I cut it before Niles comes in with a spoken word exhortation. All right, final clip for Dave.
Are we tied right now?
Yes, I am here, and Nick and Dave are tied with 18. So, okay. Dave, you just have to get any information, correct? Oh, and then you win.
My God. Let's hear that clip.
Went to the show, and I found my girl. Holding hands, somebody rocking her world.
Bitch can sing.
Oh boy, that is not familiar. I will take a hint on that one.
Your first hint is Diallo Riddle.
Don't know who that is. Take another hint.
This is for everything, Dave.
Yeah.
Your last hint, Bashir Salahuddin.
Oh, okay. Oh, boy. So this is one of two shows. It's either going to be Southside or Sherman Showcase.
Mm-hmm.
Can I listen to it again?
Sure.
Went to the show, and I found my girl. Holding hands, somebody rocking her world. And when we try to make it right,
that bitch can sing.
I mean, I don't remember that from Southside, but I'm not sure Tatara would be so cruel as to fit Sherman's Showcase into this, knowing nobody else but her watched it. So I am going to say Southside?
He did it. I stopped watching Sherman's Showcase. I wouldn't give that to you. I know you don't watch it.
Yeah.
So let's get the final scores.
The final what?
Do you want me to say that again? Okay, sorry. Let's get them final scores.
I was present with 7. Nick, very creditable performance with 18. And, oh, nope, excuse me, with 13. And Dave at 14.
Woo!
Dave.
Yay me.
What am I buying Dave?
What is something Dave missed? He missed Taskmaster. So you're getting in something themed to Taskmaster.
I got Taskmaster.
No, you didn't.
I answered it.
Oh, yeah, you did.
Yeah, he did.
What else did you get wrong? Newsreader you got. Futurama you got.
Got everything.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, you're off the hook, Sarah, apparently, according to the rules. Congratulations. I was too good.
I'll give you one of his questions.
Dave. Well, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We audited the college spinoff of The Boys Gen V before going around the dial with stops at Starstruck, Only Connect, and Feud. We said go Pirates to Sarah's cannon pitch for the Veronica Mars pilot. And we crowned winners and losers of the week, and I, Dave, was the winner of this week's Game Time from Tara. Next up, find us on Friday for our findings on Found, the missing person drama you can find on NBC, and join us next week here on ESG Prime for the Kane Mutiny Court-Martial. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Colt, and on behalf of Tara Ariano, Sarah D. Bunting,
Shelley Pomeroy's party really sucked,
and Nick Ridewell-Jones,
I'm off to Dick's Sporting Goods.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Grain.
It takes a while. It's not fun. It's gross.